It's amazing the overlaps. Melancholy. I don't know if my cake that I'm going to talk about at some point can compete with Catherine Bell's, but it's really amazing to see so many provocative. My brain and creativity has really kicked in with this conference, and I really appreciate the obviously the organization, but also all the overlaps and obviously the thematic thought that went into it. I come to you today as a novelist, as a practitioner, as a theater maker. I guess as we decided yesterday to call Paul, for example, mainly an actor, director, educator, person. But I'm here with an agenda. I've gotten really curious about where, you know, I've studied a lot and so on and practiced for many years, but I've gotten really curious about where my art comes from. So this is a little bit selfish today, but, you know, bear with me. I wrote a novel called The Drifts. And it came out this year, and I've been an actor in TV and film and all that sort of thing for almost 20 years. And whenever I've done press, and I've done a lot of it recently, the first question is always, what's the book about? But the second question is, what inspired you to write the book? And I usually give a nickel answer. So I say, look, you know, I grew up with my aunts who told me these stories about this little town in Arkansas called Bay. And my book is not a retelling of those stories, but it's absolutely informed by those stories. That's true, it's all true, but it's not quite complete. The book is caught up with gender, history, and memory, just broadly. It's about four people fighting like hell to get what they want over 3 hours in a really nasty blizzard in Arkansas, northeastern Arkansas. One character came to me very early, Julie. And Julie is really, when she came to me, I'd never had a character come to me that was so bitter, so angry, so resentful. She's 46, she's found herself pregnant, her two daughters are grown, she thought this is the time my life is going to start, and she's pregnant. And her husband won't talk to her about it, Charlie. So, she's not depressed, exactly, but she sure isn't elated. She's obstructed, and she's frustrated. I discovered this painting by Degas, Melancholy, early on in my writing, not knowing any of the material that I'm going to share with you today. And that painting has kept me in touch with Julie and her sort of core anger, that original impulse that I had about her, and little did I know the serendipity of my attraction to that Degas. Engagement with ideas, skill, craft, and materials sometimes ends up in art. And every piece of material that we use carries in it a faint pulse of its original intention or its original embodiment. That's its aura. I would argue that the same goes for the ingredients in recipes. Aura is, as Benjamin says, its original authority. Art colludes with original authority or authenticity to create something beyond the detached, technologically reproduced tchotchke, to something tethered to origin but anchored in a new artifact. This artifact is a vessel crafted for this something beyond hope, faith, transcendence, and so on. There's Benjamin. I love that photo, the way he's looking at it. You can ignore the text. It was just his eyes. Have you seen this angel before? Yeah? This is Paul Klee's Angelus Novus, the new angel. And it's really helped me to understand where my book comes from. Instinctively and rashly, I use Benjamin's description of that angel's business as an epigraph in the front of my book, before I even really thought about it. My publisher wanted me to fill up some pages at the top, and I was like, okay, well, so I looked around, and then that angel came to me. The angel's gaze is transfixed on the past as a storm. The storm of history blows him into the future. The storm of history is also the storm of progress. And so here's what he's got to say about it. A storm is blowing from paradise and it's got caught in his wings. It's so strong that the angel can no longer close them. This storm drives him irresistibly into the future, to which his back is turned. While the pile of debris before him grows up towards the sky, and what we call progress is this storm. Benjamin's debris describes what remains from the storm, what has not blown away. Clay agreed with him. Although gender, for example, shapes how we get through life, one of many things, the remnants of our experience, that wreckage, nourishes us uniquely. And I'm going to situate that debris pile as the site where the progression from aura to art progresses, happens. And that art is food. When I say food here, I'm referring to the physical, the psychological, the emotional, the financial nourishment that art brings to human life. Here he is again. There are, if you could see, there's pieces of rock and whatnot flying around there at the bottom as you move down. And after a long time sitting with this angel, my perception changed. Instead of seeing what was there, I started to see what wasn't there. And what I began to see is the space necessary for artistic creation. Anybody that writes, that does art, knows that there's a certain space amongst all the debris, if you will, that we need. Since both Clay and Benjamin call this debris from the progress of history, naturally, I began to ask myself, well, what's my debris? And did it contribute to the drifts? Certainly, I know from my own practice, not to mention the stories my aunts told, that memories, photographs, smells, cotton fields, and all the rest were pieces of wreckage from my own history. Text and language, Benjamin says, manifest a materiality all their own. And for my family, for example, the phrase brown cake releases a flood of memories, events, and story, though it's nothing more than flour, sugar, baking powder, and so on. Interaction with texts, which I'm just using as anything that's readable, with art through practice or witness unfreezes image or word and liberates them into multiple meanings. When we write or tell allegory, we both constrain and release history. Allegory, like my book, for example, reconstructs but does not reproduce auratic traces. It's this process that is, for Benjamin, messianic. Because we engage with these texts, Benjamin says that we are the messiahs we have dreamt of. And as usual, he's onto something. Terry Eagleton asserts that if allegory enslaves objects in meaning, which it does, you can see that cow on the front of my book, these meanings become multiplied. It's this multiplicity that liberates meaning. Art and allegory are not trying to pass on information. They seek to convey an event of the mind or spirit, a moment of faith, transcendence, and so on. This conveyance displaces the original intent, authority, aura, and so on, and integrates it into the receiver's experience. And when I tell you about spending time with my now deceased aunts, you get some of them in your experience. Allegory depends upon traces, the Freudian concept that Benjamin uses to describe events, feelings, emotions, and so on, that come along with human historicity. Eagleton says trace is what marks an object's historicity. The stiff melted sugar from my family's brown cake is different than other melted sugar because it has been heated, stirred, and spread by our hands. My novel is different than yours, substantively, because we have different traces. But when you read the drifts, you recognize the authenticity and authority of the traces there. Traces are inscribed or written, if you will, by who has created, consumed, or used them. This inscription gives traces their identities. The authenticity or authority of this identity is what gives or disrupts a trace's persistence over time. And if authority gives trace persistence over time, it feeds the progress of history. or, if it's diminished, not. But traces are not just vestiges of original authority. Traces are further constituted by the social relations in which they're caught up. They exist in economies of getting what we need to survive, right? And that's Benjamin's historical materialism. But the exchange of commodities is not the whole story. It's a profound transformation from authenticity to commodity. We humans intentionally survey and choose traces of our histories to manipulate into material things. A painting, a cake, a book, a souvenir doll. One distinction between paintings, homemade cakes, books, and souvenirs is that the first three convey traces of original authority. And we all know from our time in gift shops that traces can be reconstructed as bric-a-brac, domestic articles used to preserve pieces of self. These pieces could be understood as capturing and freezing a diminished aura or history for purposeful deployment. A technologically reproduced thing, say a cake that has the name brown cake, but uses my family's recipe, let's say, would be called a fake. And here's why. First, elements of a thing, say the flour, the baking powder, sugar, and so on, or a mustache, can be automated and thus change the inscription or the outcome. Second, that technologically reproduced brown cake can go places where my family's brown cake can't. If we sell our recipe to a food conglomerate, the traces in it can be employed to earn money by faraway factories, bakers, and quite soon be untethered from its origins. That original aurat trace contained in the recipe for our brown cake, reproduced by machine, loses its connection to a moment that was a here and now. This devaluation of original authority becomes politically potent. Benjamin saw this when patriotism became synonymous with the Third Reich. Reproduced traces become our ideological dupes the further we venture from original authority. A little more about that in a bit. The use of trace can be unseated, disrupted, and even stop history. The authenticity of a thing, Benjamin writes, is the quintessence of all that is transmissible in it from its origin on, ranging from its physical duration to the historical testimony relating to it. And what is really jeopardized when the historical testimony is affected is the authority of the object. And, with enough reproduction, history itself is not just displaced, but disoriented. It will not matter at all what Walter Benjamin or Pierre Trudeau had to say about anything. We'll have their souvenir doll. Let's see. Yeah. So there you see the guys. Isn't that funny? Our bric-a-brac tchotchke museums, gift shops, can be seen as funerals for the progress of history. Reproduction substitutes a mass existence for unique existence. These remnants are, Benjamin argues, intimately related to the mass movements of our day. He was referring to fascism in the guise of National Socialism, and I'll leave it to you to apply it for our own time. My family transcends these little deaths of history by making brown cake. And it goes like this. We put a couple of cups of sugar in, make the cake, but then put the sugar in an iron skillet, heat it up, you melt it down, add some whole milk, very important, need the fat, and butter. And you take it off at just the right time. But knowing when to take it off the heat, I've never seen it written down. It's not written down. Through practice and a passing on of when, that's how we avoid freezing the history. That's how we pass on that original authority. Our brown cake, for instance, holds the story of when Aunt Sarah ruined the cake by leaving the sugar and milk on the fire too long and spreading it. She took the whole cake off. And she was convinced for the rest of her life, she just died in her 90s a couple years ago, she was convinced that that ruining of that cake damaged her marriage until her husband passed. She was convinced. And so I, for example, cannot make a brown cake without knowing that it could become like an emblem of my own stupidity, right? And that's aura's persistence over time. The making of our cake is a site of transformation. It's where we move from that mucking up of the cake, that debris, to moving us along in our own histories now. It's how we stay connected to that former here and now in our own here and now, from our harried, disconnected lives to the generations before and after. And we manipulate authenticity for a million reasons. I do it for novels or theater making. Others do it to dam up the storm of history or to fetishize the Fuhrer, Fatherland, or the Volk. Although I'm not going to go into this here, shutting down authenticity and historicity make genocide, liquidation, and environmental destruction possible. Art resists our tendency to enshrine and to fetishize. We can march through our lockstep, black-berried lives, but art resists it. At this point, brown cake is in my body, and if that's the case, who needs the recipe? Who needs dogma? My great-great-grandmother brought it back with her from the Trail of Tears when she escaped up into the mountains, or so that's the story. It's a historical dialectic that's alive and refreshed with every retelling through craft, skill, material, and it opens the way for mystery, recognition, and freedom to seep into our bodies and minds now. But how do we get that into play? And this is where my questions really kicked in here. In order for liberation to happen, traces must be brooded over. The psychological and emotional state of melancholy is accessed by brooding. When we locate ourselves somewhere between elation and depression, in melancholy, we can brood. I know this from my own arts practice, from the research I've done for this paper, and from my elders. I've studied with some really sad people. There's a wonderful poet and novelist, Aram Saroyan, William Saroyan's son, who told me, "Tom, you know, you got to be sad to write." I didn't know what that meant for a long time. I think I have a better idea now. Another great teacher of mine, Hubert Selby Jr., Cubby, an old smack addict and alcoholic, said that it's our job as artists to transcend the human ego. And he really came through. I'm not sure I totally understand what he's saying, sort of on one level, but he really came out of some intense darkness into the freedom of melancholy. And artists and cooks need to stew over traces and ingredients in order to reconstitute them into something, a book or a cake that emancipates each ingredient's original authority and then multiplies it. To ignore this task is to fetishize. We must brood because it leads to liberation. To not brood is to freeze history, to paralyze it. There it is. Artists do this brooding. It's our job. An artist is in the business of assembling and crafting auras for the purposes of expanding human life and experience, of feeding us. Look at this etching by Albrecht Dürer, Melancholia 1. I see an artist at work there. The etching, from 1514, is a precursor to both Paul Klee and Edgar Degas. Look at his face. Can you see, make out his face? The light's a little bright. His gaze is fixed too, like the Angelus Novus, but he's more obviously disturbed and brooding. And at this angel's feet, you can make him out, there's a compass, there's a sphere, there's a polyhedron, there's nails over there, all sorts of tools. And we all have our tools to create. At my feet are brown cake, Arkansas stories, my aunt's fear, and my own experience. I have my pen, my notebook, my MacBook Pro. I have editing, word choice, rhythm, and so on. This is what an artist is compelled to do, bring a natural and organic form to trace through tool. Memory, suffering, narrative line, editing, the prophetic pull of momentum and plot. That is, according to Klee, Paul Klee, an organic formalism, not a technological one. That's what Julie is doing in the Degas painting. She's brooding over the material of her life. She's wondering what she's going to create now that her daughters are grown. Her unwanted pregnancy threatens this brooding, and thus her own liberation, and her husband won't talk to her. She's not unlike Dürer's angel with his tools, the hammer, the saw, the compass, and so on. Melancholy is the psychological and emotional state of art creation. Hansen argues that Dürer's Melancholia 1 fundamentally inaugurated an altogether new, this is in 1514, even modern sensibility. Panofsky, the iconographer, stressed that Dürer, quote, rekindled a long-lost positive conception of melancholia already lodged in Aristotle's Problemata and the Italian Renaissance humanist who associate it with Plato's mania. Durer's etching wrenched a personified subjective disposition or mood from a mere ideogram of a temperament. End quote. Benjamin then went one step further and made melancholic ambivalence into the mechanics of the dialectic. This then is the answer I was looking for. Where does my book come from? Or any artistic thing I create? It comes from a melancholic state induced by the dislocation or displacement of traces brought about by brooding. Brooding unseats trace into something new. It's up to us whether that becomes nourishment or depletion. Aura diminished easily slips into tchotchke, but can expand into art. Aura at presence can be fetishized through commoditization or resurrected through art. To resurrect is to engage in the dialectical relationship. For me, for a novelist and theater maker, my means of accessing aura is through allegory, through space and the body. In the time available, I've left out huge chunks of discussion about, you know, further discussion about bourgeois commodity, the gaze, G-A-Z-E, teleology, and I would love to write more about German tragic drama, about Trauerspiel, right, which I think has a lot to do with this book, my book. I really want to thank you for letting me look into that debris pile a little bit. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for your attention.
Good.
They were on the same page. They were on. Benjamin actually owned the painting at the end of his life, and yeah, he tucked it. A friend, I forget which friend, tucked it into the Bibliothèque Nationale when he had to flee Paris. So yeah, he owned it. So they agreed on the interpretation.
That's interesting. I came on the avenue yesterday and then looked at that image everywhere. It took a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. And I.
Yeah, we're only seeing it through Benjamin's eyes, aren't we? But yeah. I didn't realize that he owned it. I have no idea about it.
He did, and you know, what I gathered, and there he is. What I gathered and came to understand in working with the image and reading Benjamin around this painting and Clay and Heidegger, for example, was that Benjamin started to use it to understand what was happening in his world, right? Like he came to see that painting as a way to understand the rise of National Socialism and where what the hell was happening. His whole world was collapsing in that period between, you know, obviously 1933, but it started even before that, and until he died in 1940. So, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Fantastic. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, whenever I see a something in flight in art, or you know, I see movement. Right, change which can be hope. So yeah, I don't think my focus on the debris pile is not all, obviously, if it's in that or could be taken out of that piece of work at all. And I actually think it's quite beautiful that Benjamin used it to try to understand what was so, so dark. Do you know? Yeah. Thank you. Oh, Dominique. Oh, well, you know, that's interesting, because I in the book, I really tried to find the humor. Because, you know, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm an actor. It's like, you can't just lead people. Although, you know, the... So while I'm not going to focus on the ending per se of the book, but there are moments that are, you know, people say, and I think that really funny, because it, you know, so I think out of, you know, all the great comedians say that it, you know, their comedy comes out of really just horror shit, you know what I mean? Pain, right? And so, so yeah, that's the other side of melancholy, right? And then I thought it was really important to, when I saw this articulation of melancholy as not as depression and the bottom, but it's sort of in between, and that's what we straddle as artists, right? We don't, if we get totally lost in the dark, we don't have the distance to use those tools, right? We're just sort of maybe hacking away. We're not using our skill and craft. And the same goes if we're really ecstatic, right? It's just, you can't enter, or I can't anyway. And I think that's our whole life journey, partly, as artists, as writers, certainly, and so on, is to learn how to get there. Why? I don't think it can. I don't think brooding's loaded. It gets a bad name. It gets a bad rap, you know. another way that I think of brooding is, you know, I've had people say to me, "Oh, you artists, you know, you sit around, you just hash out ideas, and you don't do anything. You know, once in a while you might make something." Well, you know, there's a reason for that, because we're considering. So another way to think of brooding, I think, is to consider it, to you know, you sit around a cafe, you know, whatever. they want to see, what are you making? What are you doing? And but brooding is I've come to understand it as a tool, and not negative at all. I think it's quite constructive. I think it's quite positive, because it's a consideration of what one has, what an artist, for example, has available to make something new, to you know, to resurrect, or you know. Yeah, well, I didn't agree with him forever, and I thought, you know, I really have resisted that. I mean, I've been in the game a long time, and one of the first things, you know, of course, when you're 18 and you're starting out, you think, oh, I have to be miserable to make great art. But then that's just not sustainable, and it's not very fun. Like, it's not going to keep you going.
Is it your experience that when you're sad, you're more creative?
No. Because that's too far down. You got to be sort of in between, I think.
I just wanted to make a comment on that, that in a way, as a writer, as a playwright, actually, that it doesn't matter what you're writing, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're always in it in that emotional status, but what it means is you're always emotional writing, whether it's from enthusiasm to blind panic.
Yeah, and especially, you know, if you have more than one character, let's say, you know, you're dipping into this character's psyche, God forbid you have two or three or four people in a scene, right? One has to go into each character's point of view, or, you know, that's what I try to do, and enter their emotional state. And I don't know how to do that unless I'm somewhat removed, right? So that I can go there, and then I can come back out, and then I can go there, and I can come back out. And I think melancholy, well, I know that melancholy lets me do that. I hadn't identified it really as melancholy until, you know, the synchronicity with that Degas painting. I couldn't believe it. That was years ago I have picked that painting, and, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, I would. Absolutely. I hadn't thought of it like that, but totally. Because as an actor and as a writer, I know that after years of practice, I can access certain emotional states, let's say, or physicalities easier. And so then if I'm composing something or trying to put something together from a lot of different traces or pieces, getting to the brooding state is much easier. You know? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Helena, do you know how to turn this off? He probably doesn't. Thank you.